Welcome to Canada's most irreverent talk show. This is The Andrew Lawton Show, brought to you by True North.
Hello and welcome to you all, Canada's most irreverent talk show here, The Andrew Lawton Show on True North on this Wednesday, March 27th. Sometimes you need to break through the midweek doldrums. Hopefully this show will help you do exactly that. Although I must admit, I got very much sidetracked this morning. We've still prepped the show out. We've still booked it. I've still planned everything and researched and all of that. But I learned, I don't know, maybe like 90 minutes ago or so, of this program I had never heard of called Suno, S-U-N-O. And it is an AI. So AI is all the rage now. You can do AI-generated news, AI-generated words, content writing, AI-generated photos, AI-generated videos. And this was the first time I heard of AI-generated music. Now, people have used ChatGPT, which is one of the AI programs, to come up with lyrics. And quite frankly, if you listen to most of the crappy songs that are put out now, AI-generated is generally better than, you know, a song with one line about, you know, doing unspeakable things to people's bodies. That's basically pop radio now. But this app, which was like free, you only got a certain number of credits, which I burned through in like half an hour this morning when I wasn't working. You could make songs, and I was like, all right, let's actually just have some fun with this. So I decided to play around and see if this could come up with a theme song for True North, and this is what we got. Beacon of Light, I like it. True, we do. All right, here's the chorus. All right, then it's just, you know, an exit. It's just a little guitar solo at the end there, which normally I would never cut out the guitar solo, except in this case, it's not a real person playing. It is an AI. That is AI generated. So that is the new True North. We're not actually adopting it, but the new True North theme song, Voices of Truth, which I quite like. And I think I gave it like a one-line prompt. I just give it like an energetic rock ballad about the Canadian media organization True North. And this is what we got. Honest journalism, a beacon of light, True North strong, shining so bright. Well, that's lovely, but you know, we can't all just go to jingles and that stuff. You have to have some fun with a program like this. So I thought it might be good, to get a song about Canada's prime minister. Now, we could do any. So we could do a song about the carbon tax. We could do a song about SNC-Lavalin. We could do a song called Experiencing It Differently, although I don't know what rhymes with experiencing it differently. What rhymes with experiencing it differently? Yeah, I don't know. Potently. See, I couldn't kind of. This is why we leave it to AI. So this is the song that we landed on.
Oh, dear old Justin, with charm and grace, a leader beloved by his Canadian base. What a tale resurfaces, causing quite a stir. Appointments in blackface, so how the rumors blur. In a world of cancel culture, where mistakes never cease, our man Trudeau tries to find some peace. He apologizes, but the damage is done. A spotlight on his past, overshadowing the fun. Oh, Justin, dear Justin, what have you done? In blackface you dance your reputation undone. But let's not forget, or let's not ignore, that people can grow and change evermore.
So So that was, it sounded like Al Jolson doing it. Although, to be honest, I could actually picture Justin Trudeau doing that song himself in one of his old outfits. That is, it's called a Canadian. Our colleague Artem says that should be the new outro music for the, no. We don't want to make that the outro music. I actually got, now everyone on the show is just making requests. Sean's asking if I can like get one in the style of Cole Porter. So, well, basically anything goes, which is, you know, one of the great Cole Porter shows. That's basically Justin Trudeau's government as it is. In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking, but now God knows anything goes. That's basically Trudeau's whole approach right now, where anything goes, although it's finally catching up with him with the poll numbers we've been talking about over the last, our numbers probably just plummeted when I started singing. Although, believe it or not, I have actually performed before, not well, but my friend Tal Bachman, who's the fantastic singer-songwriter, he was doing a musical night on the Mark Steyn Cruise, and he's invited me to sing along with him a couple of times. So I performed with, I'll say, Rock Royalty in Canada. See, I should just get AI to generate the show, and we'll go from there. Sean is asking if Tal Bachman's related to Michelle Bachman. No, she has two N's on Bachman. He has one. Although, believe it or not, I have sung with her as well. We sang on a previous cruise, Sway, in the style of Michael Bublé. So there you go. You're learning all sorts of stuff about me on The Andrew Lawton Show today. Have to start off on a fun note, although we have a little something planned for the end of the show we'll get to on that as well. But I don't think it beats the Al Jolson, Justin Trudeau number there. But let's talk about the Liberal government in freefall here. As I mentioned, their poll numbers have not been favorable. The polls are showing, at the very least, a massive Conservative majority. But more importantly, reducing the Liberals to, some polls are saying, third party. In some ways, it might conceivably end up where they are the fourth party behind the NDP and the Bloc Québécois. But what's fascinating about this is the way they behave. There's a particular amount of hubris we're seeing, and one example of this comes from Ken Hardy, who is a British Columbia Liberal Member of Parliament, who is kind of like the Mark Garrettson of Twitter. I mean, I guess Mark Garrettson's the Mark Garrettson of Twitter, but he's very Mark Garrison-like in that he just spends his time saying these ridiculous and absurd things online. Now, unlike Garrettson, Hardy will get called on it and will apologize for it, and then we'll do the same thing a little bit later on. In particular, one of the things he loves doing is comparing Pierre Poilievre and the Conservatives to Nazis. Now, this is a tweet. This is the original tweet, so not the one from this week. This is the original tweet where Ken Hardy says, if Joseph Goebbels can pick up question period down there, he will be so proud of Conservatives spouting a lie often enough and loudly enough. It is a tried and true tactic. Spouting multitudes of them, the Tories have perfected this. This is, Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi propagandist, one of the most horrific people of that era of history, and Ken Hardy is just making that comparison rather freely. It's the old line, Godwin's Law, that all internet arguments will eventually devolve into an invocation of Hitler. Invoking Hitler is kind of the starting point for people like Ken Hardy. Now, he apologized for this. This was him in the House of Commons.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I did go elbows up on Twitter, and I apologize for that. I did, though, attempt to raise the issue the other day of the frequent misrepresentation coming from the Conservative side, but elbows up was a little too much in this case, and I do apologize.
So he gets called on it. He apologizes. We're all supposed to believe that everything is fine. Everything is fair game here. And then we see this tweet from him just this week. He references the previous controversy. Now, I got into a bit of trouble a while back by invoking an awful historical figure when pointing out Pierre Poilievre's use of the big lie strategy. But, oh no, he did the but. But day by day, there's more and more proof that this is exactly what he does because he doesn't have much else to offer. So once again, we have Ken Hardy, again, aware of this, aware of the previous controversy, saying, yeah, I know I said it, and I know I apologize for it, but every day it's seeming more and more appropriate. Now, Melissa Lantzman, who is she's been on the show before. She's the deputy leader of the Conservatives. She is a very prominent and outspoken member of the Jewish community as well. The type of person who is, as a result, I think, particularly sensitive to Nazism and Nazi comparisons. Now, Melissa Lantzman herself, you may recall during the Freedom Convoy, was accused by Justin Trudeau of standing with swastikas, or standing with people who wave swastikas, whatever his line was. She jumped on Ken Hardy's comments here, and I wanted to share that with you. She says, does this guy have no one in his life that will tell him to stop invoking Nazis, especially now? Are you serious, Ken Hardy? I'm glad I won't have to sit in a room with you after the next election. I'm sure there are a few of your colleagues who feel the same way after this tweet. Read the room. And she's referring, of course, to the fact that Ken Hardy is likely to be ousted next year. His riding, he carried it pretty decisively the last couple of elections, but it's historically been conservative. And if you look at some of the polling numbers in and around BC, I think he's in the Surrey area, it's particularly not hospitable to the Liberals. So he's apologized once again, sort of. Some folks object to my invoking unsavory past figures when noting Pierre Poilievre's habit of lying. Okay, I apologize. As for the widespread view that he lies, well, some free advice from Cicero. Oh, he's dropping another historical figure now. When people speak ill of you, live so that none would believe them. So I feel he just Sean is saying it's very cryptic. I feel he just searched for a quote about lying, and he basically just used an AI generated tweet machine for that. I think I should have gotten Ken Hardy's tweet done as a song. Maybe I'll do that for tomorrow's anytime, Ken, because it would be more entertaining to listen to Ken Hardy in some AI generated pop ballad rather than some AI generated member of parliament talking. But that is basically his approach here. He's going to call Pierre Poilievre a senior Nazi, apologize, reference it, do it again, apologize again. So basically, we just need in Ken Hardy's office, like one of those old factory things, if it's been 0 days since our last accident, it's been 0 days since our last Nazi reference. And you won't even need to buy a lot of numbers, because you're probably not going to get more than 1 or 2 days before he does it again at the rate that he's going. Absolutely absurd. And what we're seeing here, though, is a very desperate Liberal Party. Now, look, there are always going to be some people in caucus that are a bit more outspoken, that are a bit prone to foot and mouth disorder. But what we see here is that when the Liberals are as desperate as they are, they literally go Nazi. That's the line that they go to with conservatives are Nazis, because they genuinely believe it. And this is the problem. We hear all the time from people like Justin Trudeau, for example, about the need to reinstill civility in politics. And we need to build bridges. We need to work across the aisle, all of that. And where is that attitude? Where is that desire to be conciliatory and magnanimous when you have Liberal MPs that are accusing people of being Nazi propagandists because they disagree with them about the carbon tax? It is an absurd, absurd development here. Yet it's the kind of thing that they get a pass on. Now, Ken Hardy, look, he's not a senior member of the Liberal caucus by any stretch. He's not a cabinet minister, but he is, I don't think, saying anything that he doesn't truly believe. And that's the most important point here, is that we're not talking about someone who made some errant slip of the tongue in a debate. We all get heated. We all say things that maybe we wish we could take back. We're talking about someone who is being very transparent about what it is that he genuinely believes, what it is that he thinks of conservatives. And you expect conservatives, let me back up and say it another way. Do you expect people to reach across the aisle and work with folks who think they are Nazis? So it's only people on the right that tend to be criticized for not being as collaborative and cooperative. People say, oh, well, Pierre Poilievre, he's just a name caller. He doesn't have a plan. Well, he's not the one calling people a Nazi because he disagrees with them. There's that old meme that's been circulating I don't know how old it is, but for a few years right now, there's a meme that's been circulating where it's basically the fake cover of a children's book. And it's, you know, everyone I don't like is Hitler, or everyone I dislike is Hitler. And that's basically the Liberal campaign platform in this country. It's just, if you don't like them, they are Hitler, they're Nazis, they're far right, they're going to, you know, do X, Y, Z. And historically, You've had a media in this country that I think is willing to adopt this language, at least in part, willing to adopt the language, at least in part. Now, I wanted to turn to again, we have to talk about the carbon tax because everyone on the internet, everyone in the country seems to be talking about this because it is coming into effect. The increase is coming into effect on Monday, a 23% hike in the carbon tax, which is adding insult to injury for Canadians who are already grappling with rising cost of living. You're going to see instantly an increase in the cost of fuel, and you'll also see the trickle-down increases in the cost of groceries, the cost of your gas bill, and all the like. But one of the things that I will point out about this is that the Liberals have not listened to anyone. They don't want to listen to anyone. They are purely ideological on this. Now, Justin Trudeau has been faced with mounting criticism from premiers, not just conservatives, from premiers, from provincial party leaders saying, we've got to give people some release. We just can't deal with this. He sent a letter to premiers thanking them for raising the issue of Canada's carbon pricing system. He says, our government is acutely aware of the increasing financial pressure facing Canadians. We know that they want to make life more affordable. This is what we're doing. This is why we made this revenue neutral. He claims that the Parliamentary Budget Officer has confirmed that, which is, by the way, simply untrue. The Parliamentary Budget Officer has not given any confirmation of that whatsoever. And it goes on and on. But then here is the kicker of this. He says, since Canada's carbon pricing system was first introduced in 2019, we have made it clear that we are open to working with any and all provinces and territories that want to establish their own pricing systems as long as they meet or exceed the national benchmark. British Columbia, Quebec, and Northwest Territories continue to operate their own systems and are not subject to the federal backstop. When we engaged with you in 2022, all of your governments either did not propose alternative systems or proposed systems that didn't meet the minimum standards. So he's saying, well, it's your fault because you haven't come up with your own alternative, except the problem is provinces have very little latitude and autonomy because there is a federal minimum. So the only latitude provinces have is to actually come up with a higher carbon tax than what the federal government is doing. So Justin Trudeau is taking aim at provinces. He's blaming provincial governments we can take that down now. He's blaming provincial government, unless it's already down, and I'm just seeing it on my screen as a holdover from when it was up, so don't mind me. Thank you. We can see what Justin Trudeau is doing here. He is blaming other provinces, blaming other leaders, blaming provinces for not coming up with ideas when he has literally been the reason that provinces do not have the ability to come up with their own climate plans, because the government has said you have to have this minimum standard. And I forget what the dollar value is, but it's the one that keeps going up and is increasing yet again on Monday. So it's a particular level of brazenness here and shamelessness, I'd also say, to look at provinces and premiers as the problem. They are supposed to be members of Confederation that have not quite equal, still kind of equal standing. They're supposed to be partners in Confederation, partners in the Federation of Canada. But Justin Trudeau has decided to basically kick federalism to the curb and tell the provinces it's his way or the highway, and then turn around and blame them for inexplicably not being able to do something that he has not allowed them to do. And this is why we have, I think, increasingly frustrations from people that have previously gone along with it, or even people who are at their core on board with the idea of a carbon tax. But Justin Trudeau has a number of positions on this that just don't seem to align with the reality. He says that this is a market-based, he basically says it's a market-based product, which I simply don't get altogether. And we also have the idea that he is claiming it's revenue neutral, which again, it is not entirely clear. And it's certainly not revenue neutral for individual Canadians who are ending up in many cases spending more on this than they're receiving, despite government's claims to the contrary. And it's perhaps why you see this issue being weaponized politically by Pierre Poilievre, who's going around the country having rallies with hundreds or thousands of people, depending on where he is in the country, all rallied around this idea of spike the hike, axe the tax, whatever the rhyming scheme is he's using in any given protest. There was a great piece in the Financial Post by our friend Ross McKittrick, who is a professor of economics at the University of Guelph, wanted a federal leader who will be honest about climate policy. Ross McKittrick joins us once again. Ross, always good to talk to you. Thanks for coming on today. You are muted there, or maybe I'm muted. No, you're muted. Yeah, I'm not able to hear you, Ross. Hopefully we'll get that sorted out in a moment. But one of the things that I find fascinating here is that the Liberal government, and I'll just pluck from Ross's point on this in the column, he says, the Conservatives would rely on the heavy hand of government through regulation and subsidies to pick winners and losers in the economy as opposed to trusting the market. And this is a complete rejection of the reality, which is that his program insists on heavy regulations. The emission reduction plan has 240 pages. Of regulations, subsidies, mandates, and winner-picking grants. And he is saying that his product is simple, his program is simple, it's the conservative one that's going to be causing all of those problems. So this is where you see this weird sort of illusion work that's being done by the government on this. Now, sometimes you get leaders like Stephen Guilbeault who are remarkably transparent about this. They just want this punitive, heavy-handed approach that targets what they believe is the great culprit of climate change. But Justin Trudeau tries to have the best of both worlds. On one hand, he tries to pretend that this is this minimally disruptive, revenue-neutral thing. I mean, the line they've been committing to in the last little while is, oh, you're all better off with it. You're all making more money. You are better off with the carbon tax. You're profiting from this. And then you have Canadians saying, well, it sure doesn't look like that. You know, my price of gas is going up. And if it is actually the case that most people are getting their money back, then what's the point of the whole thing? So it doesn't actually really incentivize the behavior the government is trying to incentivize or purporting to incentivize. And the reason for that is that so many of these emitting activities are not optional for Canadians. Driving to work for a lot of Canadians is not optional. Picking your kids up from school is not optional. Going to the grocery store to buy food, not optional. So where are you supposed to cut back? I believe we have Ross McKittrick back on the line now. Ross, good to talk to you here. What is it you feel is really the misdirection taking place here, where the government is saying on one hand that this is not a heavy-handed regulatory process on its part?
Well, the comment that I made in my op-ed was that it's one thing for Trudeau to say we believe in the economic principles of efficient climate policy, but his actual policies are anything but. Yes, he's got this elegant little carbon tax going, but the real costs of his policy are all the other regulations, the clean fuel standard, the EV mandate, the building energy efficiency codes, all these other regulations massively increase the costs of his climate policy. So the carbon tax itself, it's costly, there's no question about it, but there's actually much worse stuff in his policy mix, and he was talking as if none of that is there. Now, on the conservative side, it's legitimate for them to point people to the high cost of the climate policy, but what they need to do is say, well, explain how can they be committed to things like the Paris Treaty and the net zero goals without actually planning to incur any costs of meeting them? That doesn't square up. So what I'd like is for some politician somewhere to be honest with the public and either say, we're going to do this and it's going to cost a fortune, so just get used to it, or say, okay, we've heard from the public that there's an upper limit to what they're willing to pay. This is the most we can hope to accomplish and we'll stick with that.
Yeah, I think that's a valid point on all fronts, because it's easy to target, and certainly for political reasons, I understand why you target the consumer carbon tax, that retail carbon tax that you see that's a line item on your gas bill that you see buried in the price of fuel, for example. But even, I mean, if we look at what the Alberta government did under Jason Kenney, where they said, let's go after the industrial side of things, that makes a very much more convoluted and, as you're saying, their complex process. And they're still doing, in effect, one of the same things, but it's a lot more opaque how it's happening.
Sure, yeah. When they don't like taking heat from consumers and they say, well, we'll make industry pay, I think by now everybody realizes that's just a shell game. It all ends up for the consumer one way or the other. Mm-hmm. It's either buried in the price that you pay at the pump, in the case of gas, or you you pay it directly out of your own pocket. But there's, as economists, as economics textbooks always say, costs can be shifted around, but they can't be avoided.
So what is the, I mean, just from an economics perspective here, let's just say that we agree with the core premise and we agree with the core goal, which is debatable on how much we need to reduce emissions by. What is, from your perspective, the path that a government should take to do that, if that is its stated objective here?
Well, if it wants to meet the Paris target and then go from there down to some kind of net zero target later in the century, we would, to get to Paris, I would estimate we'd need maybe a $200 a ton carbon tax. And then to get to net zero, something more like a $500 a ton carbon tax. I'm not sure even that would do it. And the current policy mix that we have, even the federal liberal policy mix, I don't think it'll get us to the Paris target. It certainly won't get us to net zero beyond that. But that's a conversation that no one's having. None of the political leaders are willing to talk to people about the costs of what they're proposing to do.
So, and that, I guess, gets at what I was hoping to touch on here, which is that this commitment itself is boxing us in effect. Like, there's no way to get to that without some sort of really aggressive plan that even the conservatives, who, I mean, again, to be fair to critics of Pierre Poilievre, he has committed to this. He has committed to Paris. He has not talked about changing the core target.
Right. And so there's an incoherency there because he's justified in saying to people, look, we hear you, the cost of fuel is too high, cost of living is too high, all these policies are driving up the cost of living in unacceptable ways. But there's no magic alternative if at the same time you're going to remain committed to hitting the Paris targets. So if, for instance, they think that you can get rid of the carbon tax and there'll be a whole bunch of far cheaper ways of doing it, then they're wrong. That is not the case. And people have tried, including past conservative governments, and it just doesn't work.
One of the challenges, and a lot of the green energy activists I find are guilty of this, where they commit to policies that are based on technologies that don't really exist yet or don't do what they say they're going to do. But I also feel that a lot of people that try to say market-based solutions are the solution are also doing the same thing, because you and even mentioned at the bottom of your piece there, you know, yeah, maybe there's a technology that will come along that will change the math on this, but right now that hasn't happened.
And that's exactly the point, that given the current technology that we have, we're very limited in what we can do. And we don't know, maybe a new technology will come along 5 years or 10 years from now. The key is, if you can decouple emissions from combustion, basically, if you can find a way to burn fossil fuels without releasing CO2, we've decoupled lots of other emissions from combustion. We've decoupled sulfur dioxide and carbon monoxide and lots of other types of emissions from combustion. But there's no technology that does that for CO2, at least not yet, as far as we know.
Now, how much of a, because the government says it is looking at that as well, and they say that all of these solutions are going to be part of the overall plan, but how much have they actually committed to R&D on that, or is it really just left to industry to come up with it on its own?
I think there is some funding for that kind of research, much more in other countries. I mean, Canada is not a big player in research in any case, but sure, people are thinking about it, working on it, but there's no easy answer for it. So because of that, it's right now it's kind of a lot of talk, but there's, as far as I know, there's people have been thinking about it for 50 years and there hasn't been any breakthrough on it. So it's not like put $1 billion up and someone's going to figure it out. Right now, all we have is carbon capture and storage, which is very limited in its applicability.
We lost your video there, but as it happens, we're coming to the end of our time anyway. So if it's going to happen, that's the best moment for it. Ross McKittrick from the University of Guelph, great piece in the Financial Post. Wanted a federal leader who will be honest about climate policy. Hopefully you'll get your wish there. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Andrew. Good talking to you.
All right. Thank you. That was, Ross McKittrick. You can even see on the screen there, RM. One thing I will say on this is that you can't, I mean, dilithium crystals, I believe, is the old Star Trek term. You can't base your policy on things that don't exist yet. And a lot of people have all of these great ambitions about, oh, solar will do this and wind will do this, and they just don't. And the really efficient and effective and clean sources of energy that we do have, like, for example, nuclear, they never seem to want to talk about. So with that, we'll, I'm sure, revisit this as we get closer to the weekend, and then big protests are going to be on Monday. And I think we just learned this morning, Pierre Poilievre, he'll be doing his own rally in Nanaimo, but there are protests in Lloydminster, outside Alberta, Ottawa, the Toronto, all over the place. So do send in your footage of those. Wanted to shift gears here to healthcare, the other hot button issue. Now, this is such an infuriating one for so many people, because virtually every Canadian who's had some exposure with the healthcare system has experienced something that didn't work the way it was, or the way they thought it was supposed to, whether it is cases of people being treated in hallways, people who have been on waiting lists for months and months and months to see a specialist, not to mention to, you know, actually be treated by that specialist. So we all defend the ideal of the healthcare system in Canada, but not the application of it. So how do we get to that ideal? Or is it that our core expectation is flawed? Well, one of the things that's quite interesting, and I'm actually surprised to see this, is that most Canadians would be open to and welcome major changes to the healthcare system. There was a Léger survey of 2,000 Canadian adults. That's quite a large sample size for a poll of this nature, that found healthcare ranks among the top three priorities for politicians, and that two-thirds of those respondents said they wanted significant changes to the system. Now, these obviously have, in some cases, come up against challenges in the courts. Most recently, the Cambi surgical case in British Columbia, which I'm sure we can talk about in this context. But let's just talk about what Canadians want here and what's standing in the way. Joining me is counsel for the Canadian Constitution Foundation, Josh DeHaas. Josh, good to have you back on the show. This is a little bit encouraging, I must say. It was a pleasant surprise to see this, because so often this is treated as just this third rail political issue that you're not allowed to do anything with.
Yeah, absolutely. So in one sense, it's, you know, really bad news, because Canadians see a healthcare system mm-hmm. that's in crisis. But what I did find encouraging is the fact that Canadians are saying they're ready for major change. So like you said, two-thirds say they want major change, and only 5% of people actually say that they want to do the thing that you most often hear in the media, which is, you know, just throw more public funding at this problem, right? So people are presented with those options, more public funding or some major change. And everyone is basically saying, we want major change. And one really interesting part of this too was, it was kind of counterintuitive to us at the CCF, but women in particular are saying that they are worried about the healthcare system and want major change. 72% of women surveyed said that they think the healthcare system is going to be worse for future generations if we don't get those major changes. And that was a lot higher than men. And we're trying to figure out why that was. But we think the reason might be that women just make a lot more of the healthcare decisions. They do a lot more of the sort of caregiving. And so that might explain why they're more worried about it, simply because they, you know, interact with the system a lot more.
You have in this country a relatively small group of activists that care very much about the structure of the system, like Canadian Doctors for Medicare, for example. But most Canadians, I feel, care more about outcomes. And you look at some of the priorities that were listed here. 46% say they want more family doctors as a top priority. Shorter emergency room wait times was behind that. Shorter times for common surgeries and other treatments. Those have nothing to do with who delivers it, with how they access it. Those are just outcomes. Those are things that people want. And I believe that if you were to put forward a system that says, listen, you're not going to go bankrupt looking for healthcare, that's not what we're pushing here, but you will get a better, quicker product, Canadians would be on board with that. But you have, again, this very small group that stands in the way of that.
Yeah, you're completely right. One thing a lot of people I don't think realize is that, you know, a lot of the opposition to any sort of reform or change in the Canadian healthcare system, a lot of that's sort of funded by sort of special interest groups like, you know, healthcare unions. And what the message that a lot of Canadians are not hearing is that, you know, Canada is just one country in the world, and we've chosen to have a very strict restrictions on private payment for healthcare. But, you know, if you look at all of Europe, they have universal healthcare. You don't have to pay with your credit card if you need healthcare, if you're poor, if you're middle class, if you want to access the public system. And most people are getting their healthcare through the public system. But they also have this sort of release valve, which is that they have a private system where if things aren't working, some wealthier people can go and they can pay to get healthcare. And that takes pressure off the public system. And the sort of the proof is in the pudding. You know, if you look at all the rankings that look at outcomes and wait times and even equity, all of the European countries are basically doing better than Canada. So I think we really need to start, you know, pushing back against that sacred cow that we can't allow any sort of private payment in Canada.
Just to bring the legal context here, I know the CCF had taken up the long-running Cambie case in British Columbia there, which I spoke about. I think it was with, I can't remember if it was with Joanna Baron or Christine Van Gyne or both, but when the decision came up. But as a bit of a primer there, how does that decision stand in the way of what you and I are talking about and Canadians seem to want here?
Well, so British Columbia, like most provinces, has some restrictions on you know, doctors work offering private surgeries or doctors or health insurance. And each province is a little bit different. But the idea is that Canadians supposedly want a government monopoly on healthcare. And so we've got all of these restrictions. And in that particular case, we said, you know, if you're waiting on a waiting list for a surgery and you're in physical pain and you could pay to relieve that, but it's just a law standing in the way, you know, an arbitrary law that is supposed to guarantee you reasonable access to healthcare, but is actually forcing you to wait on a wait list, that's violating your constitutional rights and that shouldn't be allowed to stand. And, you know, there's a 2005 case that found that to be the case in Quebec, but it doesn't apply in the rest of Canada. So we thought that in British Columbia, we would be successful, but the courts there said, no, this is a reasonable limit on people's charter rights, even though people suffer and in some cases die on waiting lists. And so right now it's still apparently acceptable to do this in British Columbia. And we don't really know what the status is in the rest of the provinces. So, you know, we're always sort of looking for our next Canby case. The fight certainly isn't over.
Well, and there, I think, underscores how the ideology is getting in the way of the outcomes here. Because, you know, if someone pays out of pocket to take themselves off a wait list, and there's an available doctor, an available surgical center, no one is worse off. Like, absolutely no. In fact, the public system is better off because one more person has come off that wait list, which helps the person behind them. So I really don't get how you... Like, it's such an inexplicable decision, just not even looking at the law, just on the logic of it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I also don't understand that. Like, you can look at, for example, look at Norway, and it's the country that ranks better than any other country in, you know, the OECD for its healthcare outcomes, for its healthcare equity. And it does better on cost than Canada. Canada has a very, very expensive system. And, you know, they have only about 10% of people there have private insurance, and they get, you know, some specialist appointments quicker. They do get some surgeries quicker, but it's optional. And 90% of people are happy with the public system and stay in that system. But just taking that, you know, 500,000 Norwegians out of the public system makes the waiting lists in the public system shorter for everyone. And, you know, Norway can actually do a lot more in their public system because they're not, because they don't have to look after 100% of the population all the time. An interesting sort of result from this survey that we did with Second Street and MEI was that Canadians actually rank pharmacare extremely low. Their priority, it's like ninth out of nine options. Only 3% said it's their top priority. And that's because Canada can't seem to figure out the basics, like getting you your family doctor or reasonable ER wait times. Norway, or they can afford to actually do pharmacare because they also allow some sort of private money into the system. So I think it's pretty clear at this point that Canada's system isn't working, that it's, you know, violating Canadians' constitutional rights. And the survey that we've just done seems to show that the public is kind of ahead of the media and some of the sort of politicians on this particular topic, because Canadians are ready for change.
One thing, I mean, maybe I'm a bit of adult, so it's probably easier for you than for me here, but it's navigating this issue of what is legal and what is just tradition has been incredibly difficult. I mean, Ontario is a great example of this, where you've got a couple of literally private hospitals that are there because they've just been grandfathered in. You have federal regulations, but healthcare is provincial. And I think a lot of that jurisdictional ambiguity is used by politicians that don't want to touch this issue. Provincial leaders will say, oh, well, the federal government handcuffs us on universal healthcare. The federal government will say, oh, well, healthcare is a provincial issue. So at its core, if we wanted to have some progress on this issue, where's the starting point? Where's the way into that? Is it at federal level with the core Canada Health Act, or is it provincial?
Yeah, I think it's actually both. So the Canada Health Act is not as clear as people think it is. So just for a little bit of background.
I'm glad I'm not alone in being utterly confused when I look at it then.
I was reading about certain aspects of it last night, and it's confusing. So the basic idea behind the Canada Health Act is that the federal government is going to give provinces money to spend on healthcare, even though healthcare is a provincial jurisdiction, right? So but to do so, Canada, in exchange for that money, wants certain guarantees from the provinces. For example, that, you know, people are not going to be charged user fees or things like that. But there's so much ambiguity in it. One really good example is diagnostic services. So, you know, getting an MRI, most of Canada, you can walk into a private clinic, put down your credit card, and get off the public wait list if you want to by paying for that MRI. Well, one of the places you can't do that is Ontario, unfortunately. So, you know, we're stuck going to Gatineau or to Buffalo if we are worried about being stuck on a wait list. So,
oh yeah. So I live an hour from Port Huron, Michigan. You cross the border and billboards advertising to Canadians, you know, get your MRI, you know, $129 or whatever, you know, go here, open 24/7.
Yeah, we have them. I'm in Toronto, and we have them on the subway saying, you know, go to Buffalo for all your surgeries or services. But anyway, the point is that the federal government and the provinces don't even seem to know whether that is supposed to be covered under the Canada Health Act. And The Trudeau government in 2018 said suddenly, actually, you know, this should be something that provinces are required to not only pay for, but stop anyone from buying privately. And so, in our opinion, this is contrary to the Canada Health Act. And they started fining provinces like Quebec and Alberta and British Columbia just for allowing people to get out of the public waitlist line, go to a private clinic, and pay to have the healthcare that they need. So there's a lot of ambiguity. And I think you could clarify the Canada Health Act. You know, I think it allows provinces to do a lot more than they say that it does, but there's no reason why the federal government couldn't clarify the Canada Health Act and say, look, we're still going to fund universal healthcare. We're still going to give you just as much money, but we're going to let provinces innovate to some degree because the status quo just isn't working. So, you know, if I was in charge, I'd probably start with just clarifying that Canada Health Act.
Well, yeah, there we go. And obviously with polling, I mean, the cynic in all of us says politicians are responsive to polls more than their core convictions sometimes. So if that's the case, your move, political class. You can read more about this at theccf.ca. Josh DeHaas, always good to talk to you. Thanks for coming on today.
Thanks, Andrew.
All right. Thank you. Let me know what you think. So many Canadians have absolute horror stories. I had interviewed on the show a few years ago a woman, I want to say she was from Nova Scotia. It was somewhere out east, where she and a friend of hers had started a company where they literally just were concierges connecting Canadians who were having trouble getting healthcare services with treatment programs in the U.S. And they did incredibly well on this because there are so many Canadians that said, yeah, I want to spend money and go to the U.S. I just don't know how to do it. And that itself reflects a pretty big problem with the so-called universal offerings in the Great White North. All right, I said we'd have some fun on the end. So at the beginning, I started off the show with a couple of these AI-generated songs. I have not even listened to this one. This is completely new to me. But I asked for a little bit of a PSA telling you all to listen to The Andrew Lawton Show, and I wanted it to sound authentically Canadian, so here you go.
Yo-ho, me hearties, gather you round. Tis a tale I tell, the truth profound.
Speaking of the East Coast.
A show like no other, voice unbound. Said.
Oh, where did it go?
Yo-ho. Me hearties, gather you round. Tis a tale I tell, the truth profound. A show like no other, voice unbound. Set sail with Lawton, let your minds astound. Sail on, sail on to the Andrew Lawton Show, where the news is brought and the commentary flows. With wit and insight, we make you laugh and know.
Truth arrows be thrown.
From the shores of true north, his signal strong. He navigates through the voices wrong. With irreverence and facts,
yep.
He sails along. Tune in to love, join his courageous throng.
That part scared me. All right, tune in to Lawton, join his courageous throng. Don't join my courageous thong, by the way. You don't want to be there. All right, that does it for us for today. We will be back tomorrow to close out the week here on Canada's Most Irreverent Talk Show. I like that. The Andrew Lawton Show Sea Shanty. We'll have. I like our current one, which was not, to my knowledge, AI generated. Anyway, we will talk to you all tomorrow. Thank you. God bless. And good day to you all.
Thanks for listening to The Andrew Lawton Show. Support the program by donating to True North at www.tnc.news.